We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you
from the terrible secret of space.
So we are continuing from last week's lesson on planetoids, planets and planetary bodies, or, you know, just planets. And we are moving beyond the asteroid belt out into our jovial Jovian planets, such as it is.
And as Carl Sagan would say, we're continuing in our mind spacecraft out beyond the terrestrial planets to the vast, mysterious planets known as the Jovians.
To the meat planet. Oh, that video. Anyway, so we're gonna finish up this little series on the planets, our little exposition on them this week, and we'll be covering, of course, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and sometimes Pluto.
Sometimes
Pluto.
NASA's not NASA. The whole world's just still like, I don't know about Pluto.
Yeah, it was at one point considered a planet, so I'm going to say that it's worth covering and, you know, why it's not a planet anymore. Yeah. So, let's start off. Jupiter is an interesting one because it was just revised earlier this year or late last year, that the Babylonians had possibly discovered Jupiter, unlike the Chinese as we had originally thought. And that means that it was discovered, like, about a millennia before we thought it had been discovered, which, you know, it's a pretty bright object in the sky, but
it's the third brightest object in the sky, so...
Yeah, yeah. We're talking 800, 700 BC is about when the clay tablets were carbon dated to. So that's pretty huge that they saw it and they understood that it was not a star. I mean, maybe in the traditional sense, I don't know exactly what those tablets said. They could have just said it was like a cooler star. But they definitely knew it was something different.
Something important, certainly. Because yeah. after all, it's this enormous glowing ball of something in the night sky.
Yeah.
And without all the light pollution that we have these days, I'm sure this night sky looked drastically different back in the day.
Yeah, you could definitely see a lot more anytime you go out, like, hiking in the woods or something where there's nobody around. You can definitely be like, oh, yeah, there's all the stars. Wonder where they came from.
They're there the whole time, or are they just here out in the woods?
You never know. So that's when we assume that Jupiter was first discovered. It's kind of, these Jovian planets have kind of been known since antiquity, Jupiter and Saturn, just because they're so bright and because they are so obviously moving in a different way than the rest of the sky. So it's hard to say when they were actually discovered, since, you know, it's been kind of obvious to humankind since antiquity that they are something special. However, the moons of Jupiter were first discovered around 362 BC in China, and supposedly a Chinese astronomer was able to see the moons just with the naked eye because they, you know, hadn't invented telescopes yet or any kind of vision optics. So it's debated whether or not that's actually the case.
That's incredibly impressive if that's the case.
Yeah, it's like really good eyesight. The credited discovery, of course, goes to Galileo because he got the telescope, so he saw all this cool stuff. And that was, you know, 1600s.
Yep.
It's pretty much just how all this stuff showed up.
So some fast facts about Jupiter, in case you're wondering. Its orbital period is approximately 11.8 Earth years. And it's about 318 Earth masses. Now, it's it's a lot more larger in volume than the Earth is, but its mass, obviously being a gas planet, a gaseous planet, is only 318 Earth masses. Still, though, people often think about, oh, hey, you know, it's mostly made of hydrogen and helium with some, you know, methane and ammonia and some other fun stuff mixed in with it. It's kind of like a sun almost, but people very little realize sometimes exactly how much larger our sun is, even to Jupiter. I mean, Jupiter is about 1,000th that of a solar mass. So yeah. We got a ways to go before we get into the point where you're getting some significant mass to create a solar reaction.
Yeah, and Jupiter wins the contest for the most number of moons in our solar system, clocking in at 67. We've already talked about a few of the moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. We talked about at least Europa during our exposé on planetoid bodies that have water and could potentially be used to start colonies in the outer solar system if somebody, you know, wanted to travel out that far to live.
Absolutely. And they're ranging in size from about the size of Mercury to the size of the Earth's moon and a little bit larger. So they're pretty hefty moons.
It's got quite a wide array.
Gotta love Jupiter and Saturn with all their little moons. It's almost like they're mini solar systems within a solar system.
So Jupiter, as with the rest, or most of the rest of the Jovian planets, is mostly gas, and it's debated whether or not Jupiter and Saturn have a surface. It's theorized that they might have some kind of rocky or icy core at the center or something, but in reality, you would see the pressure slowly increase as you went down, and eventually the gases would move to a more liquid state just because of the pressure, which would eventually kind of compress to a solid in the center. At least that's the other theory. So it's debatable whether it has a surface or whether it's just got a solid, compacted thing in the center that is kind of the quote-unquote planetary surface.
Mm-hmm. There's got to be something down there creating a magnetic field, and you'll often hear a lot of planetary science folks spouting about metallic hydrogen around near the core of Jupiter. And metallic hydrogen is a concept that I have a hard time grasping my head around, because you're like, well, shoot, hydrogen, it's a gas. How could it ever possibly be a metal? Well, if you'll remember from chemistry, it is the topmost element in the alkali metals column there. And if you do, well, it's theorized, if you do compress it down hard enough and with enough force, you'll actually get it to behave like a metal, in which you will be able to, well, it will share its one electron around like you would in a metal, so it will be able to hold an electric current, which is how you will end up with this giant freaking magnetosphere that Jupiter has, which is 1 million times more powerful than the Earth. In fact, it's so powerful you can actually hear it. NASA has a really cool program called Radio Jove, where you can actually go and build this $100 radio telescope, and you can set the sucker up and listen to the Jovian radiation, amongst the other things like solar radiation and the galactic background, which is pretty cool, listening to the radio waves of space.
Fun fact, Chevre built a telescope like that back when he was younger. So,
fun fact. Thanks, Ralph Leiden.
he kind of knows about that.
Yeah, good stuff. Also kind of interesting is the polar declination, if you will, is opposite of what we have on the Earth. So if you had a compass made on the Earth and you took it to Jupiter, you'll also find this with Saturn, the North Needle would point towards the South.
That's pretty cool. You know, if you were standing on the surface somewhere and not dead.
Yes. Should be a good thing to be.
Yeah.
So, also pretty cool, the rotation on Jupiter, the differential rotation. So it's actually spinning at different speeds at the middle than at the on the poles. And the interior is rotating at approximately 9 hours and 55 minutes for one rotation. And that's the fastest in the solar system if you're keeping track. Now, you might wonder, how do you track the interior rotation of a gaseous body when you don't even know if it's got a surface? Well, the way science does that is they look at the celestial object and they determine its magnetic field flux rotation. And so taking the magnetic field flux rotation, they are able to figure out that it's about 10 hours for a rotation in the interior of Jupiter.
They'd have fast days if they could see the sun from the surface.
Extremely fast days.
And it didn't just look all, you know, gaseous. So Jupiter, unlike most of the rest of the planets that we're going to be going over today, has a bunch of missions that we've, you know, sent stuff by it. The Pioneer 10 probe in 73 was the first probe to fly by Jupiter and actually get pictures, you know, send them back, that kind of deal. Then Voyagers 1 and 2 flew by in 79 on their way out of the solar system, where they're continuing on to this day. And we had a bunch of additional probes go through the Ulysses, Cassini, and New Horizons, passed by Io on its way out to Pluto this last year, although probably it was a couple of years ago by the time it was going past Jupiter, maybe a few more than a couple. It takes a while to get between these planets. And the Galileo orbiter in 95 was the first one that actually parked around Jupiter and started setting it in detail. And that's where we get a lot of our data from Jupiter from, is from the Galileo orbiter, just because it's spent, or been able to spend so much time in orbit taking photographs and measurements of the atmosphere and looking at Jupiter's moons and such. So the next one that's supposed to go by there is the Juno probe, which is supposed to hit in July of this year, and it's going to go into a polar orbit to study the magnetosphere in addition to other pieces of Jupiter's weather patterns, because we've never had a polar orbit satellite of Jupiter before.
Absolutely. That's cute. They named it Juno.
Yeah. I think that's... Is that Jupiter's wife, I think, in classic
mythology?
That would
mythology? Be Aphrodite.
Okay.
In Greek mythology, but we're Roman, so...
Yeah. And then the next proposed mission is the Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer, which is nicknamed JUICE by the ESA.
Come on, ESA.
Yeah, I know. I thought it was a joke. I was like, JUICE the satellite? Okay. That one's going to be kicking off maybe in 2022. They're still planning for the mission, obviously, because it hasn't happened yet. That one is, as the name suggests, going to go explore the moons. So the details of it haven't been fully explored yet, but that's the general gist.
Yep.
So that is Jupiter, our big gaseous friend.
Absolutely.
And now our big gaseous friend's neighbor, Saturn.
Yay, everyone knows Saturn.
Saturn. So Saturn, we don't really have a discovery date for, because this one has literally been known since prehistory, since it shows up in a lot of mythia, or it has a strong place in the mythos of the Roman and Greek civilizations, in addition to others farther back. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly who discovered Saturn. We can once again credit Galileo with discovering some unique features, like the fact that it has rings and, you know, some moons and stuff in 1610, like he did with just about everything else past the asteroid belt. Well, okay, two things past the asteroid belt. The rest of them were discovered later because they're kind of far away and kind of small and not quite so cool.
Yep.
They're cold.
It's pretty darn cold. Some quick facts again. Saturn, all right, you're looking at an orbital period of about 30, so you're actually about 29.4 Earth years. It weighs about 95 Earth masses, which, if you think about Jupiter's 318, significantly lighter. They often say if you could get a bathtub big enough, Saturn would actually float in it because it's less dense than water. Fun facts there. 62 moons, kind of ridiculous. If you remember us talking about the Titan and Enceladus a lot earlier in our podcasting history, Titan's pretty unique because it's got a freaking atmosphere, and that's the only one that's got like an actual atmosphere besides actually planets, so pretty neat. And then Enceladus, if you remember, is the Europa wannabe.
Yeah. Also one of our candidates for having an under-ice ocean that could possibly sustain life, you know, of a different type. Definitely would have to survive under different conditions than life on Earth, but that would be something for the astrobiologists among us to try to figure out, not me, because I don't know Jack. Astrobio is weird. So it's got a slightly different composition than Jupiter's atmosphere, less helium, and of course it's not quite as intensely hot. You don't see a lot of metallic hydrogen, so the pressure is quite a bit less, which is obvious because of the lesser mass for a similar-ish size. So it's a little bit less intense than Jupiter, I would say. It doesn't have major storms that we see quite so much as Jupiter does. I mean, if it does, they're buried deep in the atmosphere, and, you know, we haven't been able to probe that deep yet. Because, mm-hmm. like all these gas giants, if you try to get a probe into them, they either get melted by some kind of material or they get crushed to death by the time they get down far enough.
Yes.
So that's the joy of outer planets.
You've also got differential rotation on Saturn like you do on Jupiter, and its core spins at about 10 hours and 46 minutes for one revolution. Fun fact I forgot to mention about Jupiter is that it irradiates more heat than it absorbs from the sun. And that's due to a lot of leftover heating from its formation that still haven't been able to reach it to the surface. Saturn, on the other hand, irradiates three times the energy absorbs, but it's not because that it's still all hot and bothered on the inside. The reason that Saturn spits out more energy is because you have this interesting phenomenon known as helium precipitation, which is another reason why you don't see as much helium in the upper layers of the atmosphere of Saturn. So you have helium, which actually precipitates out of the hydrogen and forms little droplets, and they fall down through the atmosphere back towards the center of the planet. And as they fall down, they increasingly heat up due to the pressures continuing to ratchet up. And so you end up with these helium rain clouds, essentially, that end up heating up as they get closer to the center, and that causes the planet to heat up and emit more thermal energy.
Huh.
Pretty cool stuff.
That is pretty cool.
And if you're wondering about its magnetosphere, it's 1,000 times that of the Earth's, which is about 1/20th that of Jupiter's. Also, opposite of Earth's orientation, so the north and the south are swapped around. It also emits radio waves, but you can't hear it on the Earth because it's in the wrong frequency. It's actually right in the AM band, so it's being absorbed and blocked by the Earth's ionosphere. Thanks. So actually, the first time that we were able to hear Saturn's radio waves were when we put, I forget which probe into space, but we had to get out past the Earth's atmosphere to be able to hear it. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. So, and Saturn, of course, is known for its large rings. It's one of the most spectacular of its type in the solar system. There are other planets in the Jovian variety that have smaller ring systems, but Saturn's is, of course, the large, beautiful, sweeping ice bands that surround it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll only be around for another 10 million years or so, so take your pictures while you can.
Yeah, you know, time's running out. At least on a geological scale, I suppose.
Yeah. So rings, right? Everyone wants to know about Saturn's rings. Well, why does Saturn have these rings? Well, there's a thing called the Roche limit, and it's basically the limit at which something like a planetoid or an asteroid that's in orbit around Saturn or another large body can no longer withstand the tidal forces and will be ripped apart by. So when you see the rings in all the Jovian planets, all of the rings are within the Roche limit, because the large bodies that once they were had been ripped apart by the tidal forces of the planet. Also, you have contributing to Saturn's wonderful patterns on their patterns in its rings, you have these shepherd moons or shepherd satellites, these little tiny larger chunks of rock and such that are within the ring system that through the use of orbital resonances actually put little gaps in between the rings and keep all of the rings in nice, neat, orderly little rows, which make it pretty stinking cool and pretty to look at.
They're like the OCD moons of the solar system. I can relate to them.
Yeah.
Keep everything all nice and clean. So Saturn has had significantly less missions than Jupiter, a trend we will see continuing through the solar system. The Pioneer 11 probe was the first one by Saturn in 79. That's where we get some of our pictures of it. Voyager 1 and 2, of course, flew by because they were on the way out, and the guys who planned those missions were frickin' awesome and managed to hit up basically all the outer planets in one mission. You know, Voyager 2. Voyager 1 stopped passing by bodies after this point.
Yeah, Jupiter, it took after its orbital trajectory change at Jupiter, changes inclination to go up about 90 degrees upwards through the solar system as opposed to through the remainder of the outside, staying close to the ecliptic like Voyager 2 did.
Mm-hmm. And the probe that's there now, the Cassini probe, entered orbit in 2004, and it's still there taking pictures of Saturn and some of its moons. Not sure how long it's going to be in operation. I don't think too much longer is what I'm hearing, but it's given us a ton of data about Saturn over the years.
It sure has. It's been an invaluable probe, inspiring many, many generations of astronomers.
Yeah, pretty much. So, moving on to Uranus, you know, it's good.
However you want to say it.
So Uranus was initially mistaken for a star. It was seen in, is that 102 or 128 BC? I guess it was. And it was officially discovered as a planet in 1781 by William Herschel, who was looking through a telescope in his backyard, basically, and found the planet over many, many nights of observations of moving bodies. So it's pretty easy.
It's pretty cool because it's the first new planet discovered in about 2,000 years. Well, over that, but pretty cool.
Yeah, and as we get into these outer planets, they move so slowly, they appear to move so slowly. They're actually moving pretty fast, but their orbital sweep is so great that it takes them very long amounts of time to move appreciably across the sky. So it's more mathematics at this point unless observation that's telling us where we're going to find planets by looking at, you know, orbital variations in the planets that we know about right now. So William Herschel, pretty cool. He found it. It's the first new planet that we've found at that point in about 2,000 years, give or take. And they tried to name it Sidis Georgium. Sidis Georgium? That's a great name for a planet.
Absolutely. It's Latin for George's star. How patriotic of that man.
Yep, I love it.
Luckily, they decided to go with the convention that was started with the prior planets and went with the Roman mythological names for it.
Yeah. Keeps us from getting out of line. Naming a planet through the internet today, as the IAU has tried to do, is proving to be somewhat of an arduous task, considering that the kind of people who would name things on the internet are the kind of people you don't want naming things. They're going to go down in history. So this
at the planet.
So this was the first planet that was discovered using a telescope, in the sense that you can see, well, Mercury was probably, was Mercury before or after this? I think it was after, wasn't it?
You can see Mercury. It's just really hard. You only got about 30 minutes to see it.
Yeah.
But you can see it with the naked eye.
Yeah. But these ones are so far out that you really can't see it at all with the naked eye. You need some kind of optics. And as I said, it's moving relatively slowly as far as orbits go. It takes about 84 Earth years to get around the sun completely. And it's got a 17.2-hour day. And it's also got that kind of atmosphere rotating at different speeds, except this one appears to rotate faster at the poles, possibly because it rotates kind of on its side compared to everything else. Uranus
is
kind of tilted.
Uranus is, like, drunk and is literally rotating at 97 degrees to the ecliptic.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird because it's the only one that does that in the entire solar system. It's also a slightly retrograde orbit because the South Pole is above, is higher than the North Pole would be, so that by definition makes it retrograde. So it shares that, I guess, with Venus, but just because it's tilted like crazy and not actually spinning backwards.
Yeah.
As far as why, there's consideration or there's theory that it, maybe it got smacked up a bit by another planet back when it was being formed, because you have most of its moons also orbiting in that same weird 90 degrees to the ecliptic bit. But the jury is still out on that one. We're still trying to figure it out. Not a whole lot known about why it spins on its side.
Yeah. That would be kind of weird, wouldn't it? Because on Uranus, if you're standing on the surface where the sun is, wouldn't the sun look like it's just kind of bobbing up and down in the same spot towards the northern part of the sky?
Yeah, if you can imagine standing in like the poles during the like the summer solstice, it would literally just go around your head in a circle.
Yeah.
Or we really wouldn't move at all.
Yeah, it'd just be kind of hanging around. It's kind of weird. Yeah.
You have like 46 months of daylight and then 46 months of darkness.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I don't know.
That's space for you.
Yeah, space is kind of strange. So the 27 of its moons are also in its, you know, like its regular orbital path, so they are also rotating at 90 degrees to the rest of the solar system, which is kind of strange. And it also has some rings, but they are much, much fainter and much, much less noticeable unless you're really looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's got a magnetic field that's about 100 times stronger than Earth's, but because it's a much bigger planet, its magnetic field ends at the cloud tops of Uranus. Pretty neat.
So you probably can't hear it too well.
And its magnetic field rotates at 60 degrees to its rotation axis, so it's actually kind of lined up sort of kind of with the rest of the ecliptic plane, which doesn't make any sense at the same time. So if you can imagine this being Earth, if Earth's North Pole was like how messed up Uranus's North Pole is right now, Earth's North Pole would be in the Caribbean Sea.
All compasses point to the Caribbean.
Yeah. So one of the things that science is thinking about, hey, why is its pole so jacked up right now, is that maybe it's in the middle of a pole reversal. We're not sure. We'll find out.
Yeah. As with anything, these things take a long time to happen, so it's, you know, over hundreds of years of observation that sometimes we figure these things out. So the only mission to Uranus that we are currently aware of is the Voyager 2 probe flew by it in 86 and snapped some photos and sent them back. But other than that, we don't really have a whole lot of additional data on Uranus because it's really far out to send a probe. And we've been more concerned with studying the inner planets at this point.
A little bit easier to do that, for sure.
Yeah, it takes
less time consuming.
A little bit less time to send something out. Although not always, as the New Horizons has proven. You know, it's perfectly acceptable to send a mission all the way out to the last known planet-ish body just to check it out.
That was a cool mission.
So, moving on, outward and onward, is Neptune, which is our other favorite bluish planet, you know. And it's not covered with oceans or fish.
So, the discovery of Neptune, let's break this down. So, when Wilhelm Herschel discovered Uranus, they all used their wonderful new thing called orbital mechanics that had been perfected, and it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so they had noticed that Uranus was being perturbed by something, because the calculated orbital path versus where they observed it was off. So something must be out there in space that's perturbing Uranus. And that thing was Neptune. And so in 1845, a Brit by the name of John Couch Adams did the math and figured out that, hey, there's a planet and it's got to be right here somewhere. We just haven't seen it yet. And then a year later, Urbain Le Verrier, the Frenchie, in 1946, he did the same thing. So they kind of co-found the planet with math. However, it was actually found with a telescope by Johann Gall, that's not Galilei, it's Gall.
Gall.
He's a German who gets absolutely no credit for discovering the planet, except one of its rings is named after him. So, and these rings are tiny. Yeah. But kind of a contested history with the discovery of Neptune.
Yeah, and so Le Verrier and Adams kind of fought over it, since, you know, Adams was 1845 and Le Verrier was 1846. And so it was kind of, they were like, well, you know, I might have just mathematically discovered it first. And eventually Le Verrier won the debate, sort of, and the French called it Le Verrier for a while. They also called Uranus Herschel for a while, until the rest of the nations were like, guys, we kind of just can't call the planets whatever we want to call them. We kind of got to call them the same thing. So it ended up going to Neptune, because, yeah, it makes sense. It fits.
It's the convention.
Everything's good. So Neptune takes about 164.8 Earth years per year, and that means that it has not made many orbits since we first discovered it, because it takes a long time.
It just began orbit number 2 in 2009.
Yep.
Since its discovery.
So, definitely takes a while to observe full pass of this planet, which, because we're now discovering planets mathematically, and because it takes so long to make these orbital profiles of a planet through an entire orbit, that's why it's taking a while to discover more large bodies, and that's, you know, why you're hearing things about Planet 9
planet
from
X
outer
or
space.
Whatever.
Yeah, because we're just getting enough of the sweep of these outer planets, like Neptune and the planet, or dwarf planet Pluto, that we can say, okay, they're varying now based off of, or, you know, from what we predicted that they would if they were completely isolated, or we already knew all the variables or something like that. So that's why we're still finding these new planets and dwarf planets and planetoids and such farther out, because it just takes so long to get the data.
Yep.
And so Neptune, kind of, I mean, we don't know a whole lot about it because we've only had one flyby, just like Uranus, but it's similar to Uranus in composition, rotates a bit slower, I think, give or take.
It's got a 17 and a third hour day at the top on the surface, and the interior rotates at about 16 hours, which is weird because the interior usually rotates faster than the outside of something. So,
yeah,
that's weird.
And it's kind of strange.
That doesn't make any sense, but well, that's the way it is, and so that's the way it is. It's also got 14 known moons, and if you look at any pictures of it, which were taken by Voyager 2, it's got that really beautiful that dark blue spot called the Great Dark Spot. But that went away in 1994. That storm dissipated and is gone now. So if you look at any updated photos of Neptune, it's just a darker blue planet, some stripes in it, but no dark great dark spot, sadly. Yep. Same thing with Uranus. It's also got a magnetic field about 100 times stronger than Earth's, but it also ends at the cloud tops. It doesn't really extend very far.
And also, like Uranus, it was only visited by Voyager 2 so far, and that was in 1989. So, for reference, it hit Uranus in 86, and it hit Neptune in 89. So it's a 3-year gap. It's a long ways between these planets, you know.
Yep.
The solar system kind of gets a little bit more spread out as you go farther away. And speaking of farther away, that ends our tour at Pluto, the dwarf planet that was once a planet, that was once a mathematical anomaly in Neptune's orbit. So it was... It's currently designated as a dwarf planet due to an IAU decision in 2006 where they reevaluated this, what they considered criteria to be a planet. And that's because we were discovering more exoplanets and we needed to be able to classify things as planets that weren't orbiting our sun, because the previous convention required that they be orbiting our sun to be planets. You know, even though it's logically like, duh, the planets around another sun are still planets, but the official definition on record didn't quite match up with that common sense thing. So they changed a bunch of stuff around, and basically Pluto doesn't get to be a planet because it's in an area that has a whole bunch of things that are the similar size to Pluto, like Charon, Charon. Now I can't remember which one that I was picking for how to pronounce that one. Out of like
Charon. That's the right one, because it's a hard C.
Out of like the 15 different pronunciations. So Pluto was discovered at the Lowell Space Observatory in 1930 by Clyde Tombaugh, who was basically just the guy who was looking at the blink comparator to check different star and other celestial body movements, and he was the first one to identify that, yeah, this is the planet. And it became this like huge thing where Percival Lowell's widow was trying to claim that the Lowell Observatory discovered it, her husband should get the credit for, you know, funding the laboratory, that kind of thing. It ended up being that Clyde Tombaugh was credited appropriately with discovering the planet, in the sense that he was the first one to be like, yeah, that's pretty much a planet.
Yep.
And its orbit is long. It's got 248 Earth years per year, which means that it has not even come close to going around in one orbit since we discovered it. Not even close.
How about that for perspective?
Yeah. And it's got 5 moons. We've gone over them before when we got all hyped up a couple months ago about the New Horizons probe that visited it in 2015 and took some awesome pictures. And
we're
gathered.
Still getting new pictures back from it.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, we're getting so much data, too. There's not a week that's gone by since that flyby that I haven't seen at least some, you know, new piece of data in the space news section of the periodicals that I check into regularly that have, you know, NASA analyzing the compositions and the quote-unquote floating islands that they observed on Pluto, of like these iceberg kind of things moving across some parts of the surface, which is really cool, and, you know, just all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, before New Horizons went by, Pluto was just kind of like this dark speck on a photograph, and we just kind of had a vague idea, but now it's this beautifully rendered, almost, you know, high definition. We almost have better pictures of Pluto than we do of, like, Saturn and Jupiter, which is ridiculous. So, yeah. It's awesome.
That's kind of the amazing thing about the outer planets, and the ones that we're still discovering are the, you know, different features of our solar system we're still discovering, is a lot of this is more mathematics than it is optics. A lot of these planets, we proved that they existed through observing the orbits and the way that things in the solar system move, you know, due to the forces being exerted on them. And then only later were we able to actually find out that there was indeed something out there doing all of this, you know, forcing around in the outer solar system. And oftentimes we just don't have pictures of a lot of this cool stuff, and yet we can definitely prove that it's there, because science is awesome.
Hey, orbital mechanics.
Yeah, seriously.
What a fun topic.
So that, unfortunately, concludes our tour of the outer solar system. There's not any more to share yet, because we still have the jury all out on that whole Planet Nine situation, but if it shows up, we'll probably do an episode on it too.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it's all about.
The Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud are all that's left out past Pluto, and that's a whole other topic in and of itself.
It's a lot of rocks.
Yeah, a lot of rocks, a lot of comet bodies just kind of floating out there in the vastness of space, just left over from the formation of this wonderful solar system, which we call home.
Yep.
Also, I think there's a mass relay out there somewhere.
Yeah, you know, because it's just waiting to be found. We just got to thaw Charon.
Yes, exactly.
Make it happen. All right, I think that about wraps it up for tonight. So until next time, I'm the Pusher Robot.
I'm the Shover Robot.
And you have gone. Down the stairs. Because you know I'm all about that space travel. 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 I'm all about that space.